The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a lecture given at California State University, Channel Islands, on April 29th of 2005. The lecture was called Race and Nation and was given by Professor Paul Spickard. Dr. Spickard is professor of history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. His special interests include studies of religion, race, ethnicity, and history. And his publications include Japanese Americans, The Formation and Transformations of an Ethnic Group, Pacific Island Peoples in Hawaii, A Global History of Christians, How Everyday Believers Experienced Their World, Uncompleted Independence, Creating and Revising Racial Thinking in the United States, and his most recent, and the focus for this talk, Race and Nation.
I'm here today to talk about world historical perspectives on the matter of race. And I do hope that this is going to get a little ink if I just hold it right there. Let me begin with a story. It's a true story. It's a story about the time that I was taken for Japanese. I was not mistaken for Japanese. It was the time that I was understood to be Japanese. This happened in the spring of 1989. I was wandering around western China in the middle of the Taklamakan Desert on the old Silk Road trade routes that linked the Middle East with East Asia. And no, I was not traveling in a camel caravan. I was traveling on public bus. And my Chinese wasn't very good, but it was good enough to get around Central Asia. 95% of the people of that part of China are not ethnic Chinese. They are Uyghurs, that is members of a Central Asian ethnic group who bear traces of physical ancestry that we usually associate with different kinds of places. That is, they have high cheekbones, brown to tan skins, eyes that look characteristically Asian. They speak a language that is a relative of Turkish. And in fact, Turks who inhabit the modern country of Turkey arrived quite late in that part of the world, and they originally came from Central Asia. The Uyghurs regard themselves as a colonized minority. When they speak of the Han Chinese, they use words like colonialism and hate and kill. And there's been kind of a low-level rebellion going on out in the desert since the People's Republic was founded in 1949 and before, because Uyghurs have never regarded their land as part of China, although the Chinese do, and they don't see that as colonialism. They just see all these people as Chinese people, and these are cute little minorities. Anyway, so I'm in this little town. It's an oasis town called Turpan, and there was a hotel and a hostel. I was staying in the hostel for 25 cents a night. And you could tell that the guy who had stayed there, who had stayed in the bed that I was in the night before, had a diet rich in lamb. The sheets were kind of greasy. And it's really hot, because it's in the middle of the desert. So, you know, I'm sitting trying to get out of the sun, because I do not have skin that likes desert sun all that much. And there's this old Uyghur guy sitting in the shade. So there we are with our backs up against the wall. Neither one of us is going out in the sun, and we try to talk. And he's got a little Chinese, and I've got a little Chinese, and so we talk a little bit. And so he says, "So you're Japanese?" And I said, no, I'm American. And he said, "What's that?" So I tried to describe America to him, and he wasn't buying it. And it's not just that my Chinese sucked, because it did, but that no place like that could exist. And you know, that was good for me as an American to hear that, because we Americans tend to kind of feel like this place where we live and the people who we are kind of define human existence. And that's pretty stupid when you think about it, but nonetheless, we tend to do that. And this was, you know, a good sort of opportunity for me to learn about myself a little bit. And he didn't have any external sources of information. There was no Uyghur language newspaper. There was no Uyghur language radio or television. The only source of news of the outside world was Radio Beijing blaring from a couple of loudspeakers overhead in the bazaar in Chinese. And this happened not once, but twice in the space of 2 days. Someone said, "So you're Japanese." And then on the third or fourth day in this little town, I began to understand what this meant. Because when I went up to the one little hotel there was in town, which was the only place in a Muslim town that you could buy a beer, and that's kind of why I went there, they had a show in the evening that happened once every 2 weeks. Of some Uyghur folks would come out and dress up in costumes of an earlier era that were quite fine and lovely, and dance and sing and do stuff like that. And the MC for tourists at this little hotel did a sort of bilingual introduction of the dancers in Uyghur and Japanese, because the only outsiders besides, well, let's see, there were three kinds of people in this system. There were people, that is, Uyghurs. There were Chinese, and there were a minibus load of Japanese tourists that came through town once every 2 weeks. And so in that racial system, I was Japanese, because that's the category for anybody who wasn't Uyghur or Han. My point is that in almost every place on Earth where people live, there is more than just one kind of people. And in almost every place in the world, there is a system of language and ideas for assorting those people. The language that sorts people out by their ancestries, by who their people are, is different in different places. Most frequently, people of various sorts who come together in a place assort them in hierarchical array around one another. Frequently, people who think about these things refer to them as these as racial systems or as ethnic systems. And I want to talk with you in a bit about what I see as the similarities and differences between race and ethnicity. Let me give you a quick tour of a few places and the ways that folks in those places kind of sort out who the relevant groups are. In Afghanistan, 38% of the people are Pashtun, 25% Tajik, 19% Hazara, 6% Uzbek, and 13% a variety of other smaller peoples. Belgium is 55% Fleming, 33% Walloon. And if you think the difference doesn't make a difference, then you haven't been to Belgium, because they don't like each other. And they talk in really nasty terms about those people and what is fundamentally nasty about them that is in their genes that goes back for generations, indeed for centuries, and is ineradicable from their character. In the Gambia, 42% of the people are Mandinka, 18% Fula, 16% Wolof, 10% Jola, 9% Sarahuli, and 5% a variety of other folks. In Malaysia, 59% of the people count themselves as Malay, 32% Chinese, and 9% Indian. But it's more complicated than that, because in Malaysia, to be Malay doesn't necessarily mean you have all of your ancestors, in fact, came from the Malay Peninsula. In fact, your ancestors might have come from Indonesia, your ancestors might have come from the Philippines, your ancestors might have come from Yemen or Aden or somewhere else on the Arab Peninsula. The thing that makes you Malay in Malaysia is that you're Muslim. And in fact, in Malaysia, there is not just different social systems, but there are different rights and relationships to ability to be part of the civitas, the civic group, depending on which of those categories you are placed in. Different schools, different access to the vote, different access to owning property, different marriage laws. And I could give you like 20 other examples, but some of you are dropping off to sleep already, and I don't wish to disturb your sleep. So it seems that what one may mean by a term like race or ethnicity or even people is quite different in different places. Let me tell you about a project that some friends of mine and I have been involved in for the last 5 years that has been trying to get at that set of differences. It is called Race and Nation. About 5 years ago, 20 scholars from countries all around the world began talking to one another on the internet about They're all scholars of racial and ethnic stuff, whatever that might be, in the places they know about, either the places where they live. In a few cases, they're Americans or they're people who live in America who are from the places that they study. The project has been to try to write a common, coordinated, together history of racial and ethnic stuff around the world. How many of you have taken a world history course or taught a world history course? Some of you, okay, thank you. Are some of you in that course right now? That's why you're here? Yeah. You know, you got a world history textbook, but there are people who write the books from which the textbooks are written, and some of them are really, really good. And I'm hoping that Professor Bushman has given you the ones that are really good, because some of them are really, really, really boring. Like, unbelievably boring, okay? And why is that? Well, maybe just because historians are boring people. Come on, think about it. What do they do? How do we spend our time? In the archives all alone, okay? We are people who lack social skills. Because, you know, if we had the courage of our convictions, we'd be anthropologists, right? But I haven't got the guts to say, just act naturally, I'm studying you. You know, I can't do that. So I go alone in the archives because, you know, there's something vaguely necrophiliac about all this, you know. You know, here I am with dead people, you know, and I'm, think about it. It's very strange what we do, okay? And you want to be a historian, don't you? You want to go to graduate school, right? There you go. We'll talk about that. Although, you know, it's a little kinky. There is something very strange about historians. Historians are not naturally interesting people, okay? And the worst historians, are you an economic historian? Are you an economic historian? Okay, thank you, good. Okay, the worst, the most boring people among all the historians are economic historians. Okay, Tom, have I offended you? I'm sorry. But no, it's really true, come on. You know, and the world historians are the most boring of the economic historians because they don't talk about stuff, they don't talk about human lives, they don't talk about anything that any of us would recognize as, but they talk about these huge international economic systems that operate over centuries. It sounds boring to me, I gotta stop. And it seems to me racial and ethnic stuff is in its nature, you know, kind of fairly interesting stuff. My first book, as Tyler said, was about interracial marriage, and that was really came from salacious interest. You know, black and white bodies, arms, legs, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's not really true. I will tell you why I wrote that book. Because I am a working class guy, I'm an inner city kid, and most of my friends are not people who read. They can read, but if they did, it'd be like People Magazine or something. But they don't read, okay? So I was going to be a bad friend to them for a period of years while I was writing a dissertation, and it ultimately was maybe going to be a book. And how was I going to explain to them the reason I was being a bad friend to them? Well, if I did a history of the banking industry in France in the 1830s, it would not be possible to explain to them that this was why I had not been with them. And so I tried to do something that had something to do that they could imagine reading. Not that they would, in fact, read, but that they could imagine reading. And in fact, a whole bunch of them have copies of the book, and they're very proud of it, and it sits on the shelves completely unread. But there it is, by God, you know, because it's got race and sex and stuff. And most of my life has been lived kind of at the margins of several different kinds of racial situations. In any case, back to the historical enterprise. So how do you write history that's history of the world that is not just crushingly boring? Because it's important to deal with the whole world. I mean, why would you imagine the Western Civ, you know, is the way to do things, right? I can't stand in front of my students, about half of whom are black and brown and yellow, and say, you know, what you need to know about is white people. You know, I just got a problem doing that. And so I think the world historical enterprise is an important thing to do. But how then do you do that in a way that isn't just terribly boring and that says something that people can attach themselves to? So what we tried to do was we got these 20 scholars from around the globe, and they each wrote about the place they know about. But it started out with a conversation on the internet, lasted about 2 years, where we just tried to talk informally about what we were doing, what we knew, what the issues were in the places we were. We came up with a series of common questions we would all address. Questions like, what's the history of the making of national identity in the places you study? What's the key period for understanding race in this place? What are the racial and ethnic groups that are currently make up the population in this place? What's the history of each of those groups? Real descriptive kinds of questions like that. Where is it all headed? What's it all mean? And then somebody from New Zealand, somebody from the Punjab, somebody from Turkmenistan, somebody from South Africa. We had a really cool bunch of people. Then we all got together in Sardinia. How many of you know where Sardinia is? Okay, these are the map people. Okay, for the rest of you, think Mediterranean, right? Italy is kicking a soccer ball. That the first one is kind of oddly shaped is Sicily. Next one is Sardinia. And then Corsica. So that's that one. There was a conference in Sardinia. We went there and spent a couple of days drinking wine and presenting papers. And, you know, it was 50-50, which was, like, the better thing to do. So each person presented a paper, and we all kind of critiqued them, and everybody went back to the places they came from and wrote a revised version of their paper. And then they sent them all in to me. I printed them, bound them, and mailed them out to everybody else. Then we all met in Santa Barbara for a sort of intellectual slam dance where, no, I'm serious, you know, where what we'd do is we'd have like one person take it, we'd all read each other's stuff, right? One person sits right here at the table and everybody else fires questions at them for an hour and a half about this chapter that they wrote and about what that says and what that implies for all the other chapters in what was going to be this book. And then they kept saying, Paul, and you're going to write the introduction and throw this in the introduction because we don't know how to deal with it all. So then they all went home and rewrote them, and they sent them to me, and we went back and forth a couple times with the publisher, and it came out last January. It's called Race and Nation. The publisher is Routledge. It's got a really cool cover. I meant to bring a copy for you. The cover is purple. It's got all these different kind of people on the cover. And if you write me at spickard@ucsb.edu, I will tell you where you can get a copy. Enough of advertising. Let me talk with you a little bit about some of the things we think we found out. And then I will entertain any questions you may have or abuse you may wish to heap. The first thing, and maybe the most important thing that we found out is that, how many of you have taken a sociology class? And did they discuss race and ethnicity and the rules about race are, and you know, this is how it works, and you know, racial systems are always like this, and like that kind of thing, right? The first thing that we found out is that that's completely wrong. You know, what's kind of difficult for me because I have now written 3 books of racial theory, and there is no universal theory. There is no universal way these things always work in all places and all times. It's just not true. That means that sort of the social science impulse, and I'm kind of on the social science end of history, but the social science impulse is fundamentally misguided when it comes to human relationships in the sense that there isn't a way it always is. There is no universal field theory. Things are different in different places. In every place, there is no place that is universal and homogeneous. There are places that have a myth of homogeneity, like Japan, where you know there's this kind of notion of blood ancestry. Everybody in Japan is all the same people. Except if you go to Japan and you get to know folks at all, you find out really quickly that, no, this set of people are Koreans and they've lived there for 4 or 5 or 6 generations and they really are set off socially in a very different kind of place. And unless they change their names from a Korean name to a Japanese name, they can't be citizens. And that there are Ainu, that is the people who lived in the northern part of Japan before the Yamato Japanese migrated over them, who look very distinct physically, who have a language that's totally unrelated to Japanese, that there are hereditary outcast social classes in Japan that are treated racially, that is, as if the difference between peoples was inevitable, inheritable, a central part of your essence. So there is that multiplicity wherever one goes. And there is a story, there is a history in whatever place of the ways that the people assort themselves and the ways that they relate to each other. And there's a history of the ways that that stuff relates to the making of nations and the ways that citizenship operates. I promised I would talk with you about the difference between race and ethnicity, or the relationship between race and ethnicity. Most of us understand those two words, right? There's race, this word is ethnicity. Okay? Race is something that has meant a whole lot of different things since it has been used in Western intellectual thought. Ethnicity is a relatively new term, although it dates back to ethnos, the Greek word for people. Some of you have an idea of what race you are and maybe what ethnic group you are. May I ask, I don't wish to pry into your lives too much. How about you? What is your race and what's your ethnicity?
Race.
Mm-hmm.
Mexican.
He's Mexican. Okay. What's your ethnicity? You're Mexican-American. Okay, that's interesting. Somebody else? How about you?
Mexican and Hispanic.
Mexican and Hispanic. Tough to tell, huh? We don't know what this is about, do we? How about you?
Scots-Irish.
Caucasian, Scots-Irish. Which is race? Which is ethnicity? Race would be Caucasian. Ethnicity would be Scotch and Irish and whatever you said, right? Okay. Interesting. And so we have a lot of different ideas about what this stuff is about. Well, let me talk with you about the lineage of those ideas for a minute, okay? Late in the 18th century, a Swedish botanist named Carolus Linnaeus. How many of you took biology? How many of you got an A? We have no takers. Okay, a couple. This is a biology lesson for a moment. Carolus Linnaeus gave us the taxonomy system by which we have assorted all the green growy things and brown furry things in the world. All of life comes to us divided into boxes thanks to Carolus Linnaeus. And he's a very smart guy. Actually, his name was Carl Linney, but he took the name Carolus Linnaeus because that sounded smarter. No, I'm serious. And that's partly because in history that is European-derived, Europeans have always felt inferior to the ancient Romans and Greeks. And once upon a time, in the time of the Renaissance, appropriated Greek and Roman thought, imagery, and history as if it had been their own. It wasn't, because, you know, those of us who are Europeans, you saw Braveheart, right? You know, blue and white, lived in the bog, didn't bathe, okay? That has nothing to do with Greece and Rome, okay? We were the barbarians beyond the gate. And my history, kind of proud of that, you know. I still don't bathe enough, probably. In any case, Carolus Linnaeus gave us this system for understanding all the stuff in the world. And I would like you to help me put this up here on the board really briefly. All of the living things in the world are divided, according to Linnaeus' system, into two kingdoms. There is the plant kingdom over here and the animal kingdom over there. And everything is either a plant or an animal, right? So far, are you with me? And that's absolutely true, except for like things like bacteria. And there are more bacteria than there are all the species of plants and animals in the world. But let us not detain ourselves with that little problem right now, okay? So except for bacteria, everything is a plant or an animal. What's the next level, anybody know? Phylum, and what phylum are we? We are the animal kingdom, right? Or the kingdom Animalia, because that's like smarter. Now, that's what they do with science, right? You know, I mean, excuse me, you do this with your medicines all the time. They got to make up medicine-sounding terms for whatever this thing is so that you'll think it'll work. You know, there's this whole language of medicine marketing. It's very strange the way we deal with this. Okay, so we're of the kingdom Animalia. We are of the phylum Chordata. That is, them that's got spines, as opposed to like jellyfish or clams. Fine, and what are we next? What's the next level? Class, is that right? We are of the class what? We are of the class, think brown, furry, Homo sapiens? Brown, furry, Homo sapiens? No, some of us are brown and furry. Yes, that's true. We're of the class Mammalia. That is, those that give live birth and suckle their young. We are then of the order. There are a whole bunch of different orders. We are of the order primates and of the... No, sorry. We are of the... I lost one. We are of the family... It doesn't matter. You get the idea, okay? I should have reviewed this before I gave this lecture. Anyway, we are of the genus Homo and of the... Oh, we are of the family Hominidae. That is, we are of the primates that walk. We are of the genus Homo and of the species Homo sapiens sapiens. Okay? That's us. And that's true, right? And each of those is a separate box, and you're in this box or in that box, right? So you're not a chimpanzee? Cool. Now, and that's the really real, that's science. Okay, and this is where our ideas from race about race come from, is from this. The idea of race and ethnicity comes from this. This gentleman here with the cap and the beard, who is a Caucasian, who is Scotch, Irish, etc., that distinction of things into big races and little ethnic groups comes from this. And everybody is in a different box. What Linnaeus did was then elaborated by a German named Blumenbach, a Frenchman, two Frenchmen named Gobineau and Cuvier, and others down two more levels to the level of race and the level of ethnic group. And we'll get to them in a minute. That is, there were supposedly four big races, black, white, red, and yellow, except that didn't sound scientific enough, so they called them Mongoloid, Caucasoid, Negroid, and Amerind, because that sounded smarter. And the idea here was that the yellow people all came from, started in Mongolia originally and kind of spread out over the landscape, and the Negroid people all started in black originally and kind of spread out over the language. That's a little weirder, isn't it? The Amerinds, as American Indians, okay, you know where that word came from. The Caucasoid people, this should help us. The Caucasoid people all started in the Caucasus Mountains, that is Georgia, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea? No. But Cuvier saw a painting of a woman from the Caucasus Mountains and thought she was the most beautiful white woman he had ever seen. And so these folks became Caucasians. This should give us a clue that somewhere we left the realm of science and got into poetry. In this system, each of these has a bunch of subgroups. So the Mongolian or Asian race, you know, Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, etc., those are all supposed to be ethnic groups, right? So there's race and ethnic group. Caucasians, Italian, Irish, German, etc., right? American Indians, Sioux, Potawatomi, Osage, Cherokee, etc. How about the Negroid race? Those of you who live in America don't know how many Africans left Africa in chains and came to America between 1600 and 1810. Anybody know? Zero. Because they weren't Africans in their own mind. The idea of Africa didn't exist in Africa in that time. And the idea of Africa was not actually European created, it was a creation, it was a Greek creation. It didn't initially apply to the whole continent of Africa, it only applied to the northern coast of Africa, Libya and Egypt and that territory. And so the notion of African, there were a bunch of people. There were a whole lot of people. Some 3 million people came to North America. I think that's the right number. About 10 million people came to the Americas entirely. Perhaps as many as 30 million people were ripped out of their homes. It was a terrible human experience. It was one of the major experiences of human history. But they didn't come as Africans. They came as Ibu and Hausa and Fon and Fulani and Asante and Ndinka and a whole bunch of other kind of folks, and they became Africans in America. And that's a process of identity change and language change and whole life change. So, you know, this is a piece of ethnicity that we tend not to recognize, whereas this piece gets recognized a whole lot because almost everybody I know who's Korean American has a sense of their identity as a Korean American and also a sense of their identity as an Asian American, and a kind of a two-level sort of identity thing going on. Most of the folks that I know who are American Indians see themselves as Indians at some kind of level, but also as members of one or more tribe, or at least as associated or descended from one or more tribes. Most of the folks that I know who are white Americans see themselves not as white people, because somehow they feel like to be called white is some kind of an accusation, so they want to be called Caucasians, because that sounds softer and it's smarter and whatever, and I'm not banging on you, that was okay. But in fact, no, we're white people. But we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about my Irish ancestors or my Scottish ancestors or whatever that kind of thing, because somehow to be white, to own white privilege and all those kinds of things in American society is like an accusation, and we don't want to talk about it. So the American system is really complicated. But I want to suggest to you this whole thing is a real complicated thing, and it's not the same everywhere. What this is, actually, forget this part down here, we'll cover that up. This stuff here is not as real as we think it is. Can I borrow, somebody got a big heavy book? That'll have to do, okay. Thank you, Ben. This is not science. This is a, well, maybe it is science. It is a language. It is a language for organizing our understanding of all those green, growy things and brown, furry things. The really real is the green, growy things and the brown, furry things. What this is a way of kind of assorting all that stuff, and it's a good way. It's a pretty good way. Let me talk with you about a different way of assorting a different set of stuff. I want to talk to you about the language of that. I'll just put that there, and then we can talk about it, okay? Excuse me. Okay, can somebody help me with this? What's happening to this folder? It's falling, right? And it's falling, why? Because I dropped it. Okay, well, no, I didn't drop it. I put it there. Excuse me? Because of gravity, right. Okay, cool. That's great. What's gravity? What's gravity? A force. Yeah, okay. Gravity's force, like the force be with you? Yes. It is a force just like the force be with you. It's an idea. It's not a thing. This is a thing. That's a thing. That thing reached up and grabbed this thing and pulled it to it. Right? Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, that's a way of interpreting that. The big thing jumped up, or the little thing fell down, or some other kind of, that's a way of interpreting it. Aristotle, I know I'll get this wrong, because I don't really care, but he had this kind of theory that like returned to like, and these were both kind of made of earth, and so earth would return to earth. Well, that's a theory, okay? Gravity is a theory. It's not just, I mean, gravity is the motive force, the central idea in a theory that was designed by a guy named Isaac Newton. He didn't feel the need to change his names, but anyway. Well, maybe he did feel the name, but he didn't have the guts to do it. Who knows what the story was? I don't know. In any case, he came up with the theory of Newtonian mechanics, that system for understanding how bodies move relative to one another, what the relationships are with one another, and it's a really, really, really good language. It works exactly the same. See if it still works. What do you think? Exactly the same. It goes at the same speed. You can measure it. You can measure its acceleration, right? Every single time, as long as you don't want to go inside the atom or off the planet. If you want to go off the planet, you have to introduce a fudge factor. If you want to go inside the atom, you're screwed. It doesn't work. So, that's a really good language. Thank you very much, Ben. I apologize for abusing your stuff. This is not such a good language. For a start, it leaves out all those bacteria in the middle. And because, well, it's kind of built on the notion that these are all separate boxes. Now let's see how separate those boxes are. How do you tell where the line is between members of species A and species B if they're right next to each other? If they're real close, real similar species, but this one from that one, how do you tell them apart from each other? The differences, right? Okay, they look physically different. So like white cats and black cats look different. So they're different species? No, they're not. They're still cats. They're just different colors of cats. What, pardon me? What if they mix? Well, then they make spotted cats? I don't know. One of the ways that biologists know these things, and they're all smarter than me. They know lots. You're a history of science guy, right? Okay, so you know about these things, right? Cool. And one of the ways you can tell is species A and species B can't mate. Well, they could mate, but that's like humans and sheep, and that's too scary. It can happen. I knew some guys in college. Don't want to go there. But human beings and like monkeys, they can mate, but they don't produce offspring, right? How about horses and donkeys? They mate, they make mules, okay? So we get a problem then, right? So but mules are sterile. Okay, so it only kind of works for one generation. Then that's science. This is how good biology is, folks. Well, fine. So how many of you have been to Hawaii? The island of Oahu? Have you been to the great metropolis of Waimanalo? Yeah, this person has. On the windward side of the island of Oahu is the Hawaiian town of Waimanalo. It's got this great view of the mountains and of the ocean. And there is a place called Sea Life Park. You should go. It's really cool. It's like Marine World, only with a much better view. And they've got all these tanks full of, like, you can watch the turtles turtling and the fish swimming and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the big deal is the marine mammals. They got these two great big tanks full of marine mammals that jump through flaming hoops and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And one of them are Atlantic bottlenose dolphins, a little bit bigger than me, probably not any grayer than me, kind of gray-colored and, you know, like a little pointed nose, like Flipper, okay? And that's one species in one tank. In the other tank, they have a different species from the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific false killer whales, that are twice as big. They have big bulbous snouts, and they're black, and they have twice as many teeth, and they got a bunch of different other kind of physical differences, and they are two species. Well, once upon a time, a bunch of years ago, and they'll tell you about this if you go there, something happened to one of the tanks. I don't know whether, you know, the dolphin crapped in it or what, but anyway, they had to clean it out. Well, you know, what are they going to do? So they drained it, they took the dolphins out and put them in the other tank, and they were going to fix it, and they didn't get it fixed in a day. And so then they left them together, the two different species, because they weren't fighting or anything, overnight. And they figured, it's two separate species, it won't be a problem. And 9 months later, out came a wolfin. And that's what they called it. And it was kind of dark gray, darker than mommy, lighter than daddy. It had a snout that was kind of halfway between the two kind of snouts. It had exactly halfway between the number of teeth, et cetera, et cetera. And they knew, because they were scientists, these are all PhD marine biologists, they knew that, of course, by the mule analogy, it could not reproduce. Well, they are now in the fourth generation. What I want to suggest to you is that this system, though it is science, is not perfect. And what it is used to do is to assort all these animals and stuff. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem with this. Because this is a language that Europeans used, Europeans of the generations that built European colonialism around the world. The same sets of people. And I know a guy who's working, in fact, right now, on the sets of relationships, the interconnections between the people who were doing, these guys who were doing this stuff, and the folks who were building French and German and British colonial enterprise, as a way of explaining how it was that Europeans were different from the people that they were conquering, and different in different ways from the different people that the peoples that they were conquering. And why it was that some of your ancestors were working in the fields while my ancestors were sitting on the veranda sipping tea. So I want to suggest that in the American system, what you've got is not race and ethnicity. What you have is groupishness. It's a scientific term. You have sets of people who see themselves as related to one another and as different from these other folks. And they relate to each other in ways that may be relatively benign. Relatively non-confrontational, not doing bad stuff to each other, relatively egalitarian. And they may have a sense of flexibility one with another as to the possibilities of mixing with one another and other kinds of stuff and forming new sets of people and stuff like that. On the other hand, there comes what I will call the racial moment. And this is important. And that's the point at which not only do I recognize that you and I are different from one another in ways physical or ancestral or historical or so in terms of our social placement, but where I write the story of the cause of that difference onto your genes, into your physicality, into your very essence, and then it becomes immutable, part of your character. And that's the reason for making up these notions of racial difference, is for dividing and dominating. We see something like that happening in the United States. I want to talk with you about this process as it has happened in the United States in not just your lifetimes, but a period of time that many of you will remember vividly. That is, since September 11th, 2001. And that is the racializing of religious identity. Time was in the United States when Arabs were regarded as white people. When you conjure up the notion in your mind of Arab Americans, almost none of you will think, aha, Ralph Nader. And he is an Arab American. Those of you who are a bit older will not think Danny Thomas or Marlo Thomas, those kinds of people, because those are just white people. And there was a time early in the 20th century when, in fact, some U.S. courts were trying to make a decision. Were Armenians, white or not? Yeah, they're white. Were Japanese white or not? No, they're not. Were Arabs white or not? And the decision was made by the federal courts in South Carolina. No, they're not. And then they changed their mind and said, yeah, they are. And Arab Americans have had, in times when other folks in America couldn't become naturalized as citizens, could not own property, Japanese, Chinese, South Asians, for instance, Arab Americans could do all those things. And they got the privileges of whiteness. And the privileges of whiteness are not inconsequential. We're still trying to work out kind of where Mexicans are in the American system, because legally, Mexicans are white people, and socially, they're brown people. And the American governmental system doesn't want to talk about it. So the census stuff around Mexicans is a mess. So this is negotiable stuff. But since September 11th, actually, so I think the process probably started earlier. It probably started around the Arab oil embargo and all that kind of stuff in the 1970s. But it really has become a major issue since September 11th. People who are identified as Arab or Muslim, or who are mistaken for Arab or Muslim Americans, have become brown people, have become suspect, have become subject to public abuse. Some examples. A woman in her 70s, I believe, let me check the age, it's at least 60s, in Orange County, California, is stopped at a stoplight. A couple of white guys rip open the door to her car, drag her out of her car, and beat her until she is put in the hospital because she's wearing a headscarf. She's an Arab. No, she wasn't an Arab American. I believe she was an Iranian American woman, so there was even a case of mistaken identity there, but she was a Muslim American woman. There's this strange idea that Arabs and Muslims are the same people in the United States. Would it surprise you to know that more than half of Arab Americans are not Muslims? That most Arab Americans, in fact, are Christians or non-believers? Would it surprise you to know that, what's the largest ethnic group among Muslim Americans? Black Americans is first in the United States. But second is South Asians, Pakistanis mostly. Arabs are third. But we don't know that because we conflate those terms. And Arab and Muslim Americans have been made into a separate, something like a racial group in America in a political time that you know about. That's a really, really significant development. What I want to suggest to you, and I can talk with you about racial system in China or the racial system in South Africa or the racial system in Turkmenistan, and there's lots of similarities and there's lots of differences. There is one universal rule about all of it, and that universal rule is it depends on local circumstances, local history, who the local folks are, how they think about each other, and who's got the power and what do they want to use it for. But in all those cases, there is the racial moment when difference is written on the body and into the genes. And that's a narrative of domination. Thank you. Okay, I'll just repeat your question, okay? The question is, what do I think about the place of religion in this business of race and ethnicity? I think it depends a whole lot on where you are. I think that there are times when religion becomes the kind of master narrative of difference and domination. But it's different in different places. And let me give you a couple examples. I think it is absolutely true that in the history of North Africa, in the period, in places like, you know, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, right? In the period from 800 or 900 down through the early 20th century, there were these major religious communities. Muslim, Jewish, Christian were the three biggest ones, and that the people in them and the government, particularly the government of the Ottoman Empire, treated those as if those were racial differences. If you were born a Jew, you lived your life as a Jew, you died a Jew, and it was not possible to change your identity. And that difference meant for very different life chances different schooling
opportunities, different marriage laws, different,
not just internally decided stuff, but externally decided stuff. There is a much stronger sense in Europe than in North America that your religious identity is ineradicably part of your character, and you are a member of a community that is a religious community, and that's not a voluntary community.
In North
America, at least north of the Rio Grande, religious identity is a much more plastic thing. The United States, since the first person I know that wrote about this is de Tocqueville, the United States has this notion that religious identity is a voluntary thing. How many of you are religious? Okay, what religion? Christian, okay? Does that mean like Catholic or Protestant or Protestant, okay? And were your parents the same? They were Catholic, okay? Interesting. How about you? Jewish. And were your parents Jewish?
Okay.
Interesting. How about somebody else? Yeah.
Yeah, raised Catholic, Christian. Well, that depends. Yes, for me, yes, she may have a different opinion about that, okay? And, you know, in America, religious identity
is more like this club or this set of people I belong to. I'm not saying it's inconsequential, okay? Because it's hugely consequential, right? Because absent a certain appeal to evangelical Protestants in America on the part of George W. Bush, John Kerry is president, you know? And then we have a different relationship to the security business, a different relationship to taxes, and a different relationship to all kinds of stuff, right? So it's consequential in America, but it's much more volitional in the United States, and it's much less part of that essence, if you will. Now, in Spain, at the time of which you speak much more knowledgeably than I possibly could, it seems to me that if you were not Christian, this was a time when Christians had reclaimed, if you will, the Iberian Peninsula and pushed out the Moors, and centuries-long process. The drawing of the line between Muslims and Christians was a very sharp thing, and between Christians and Jews a very sharp thing, so that even conversos, that is, Spanish Jews who converted to Christianity in that period, were not regarded as full, unsuspicious members of the body civil because of their Jewish ancestry, even though they professed Christianity. And that's much more like a racial identity. Did that answer your question at all? Cool. Somebody else have a question? Yes, back here in the peach-colored blouse.
Nicole.
Hi, Nicole, I'm Paul.
Hi. My question is,
you talked about how in social science there is no universal thing. And I was wondering if you think this concept enhances the study of social science or devalues its findings.
I think social science, the question is, okay, I said something snotty about social science that the universal laws after which they are reaching aren't universal. And the question is, does that enhance the value of social science or tend to undercut it? I think social science is really useful stuff. And because social scientists are very, very good at kind of dividing things into categories and measuring those categories very precisely and measuring change in those categories over time and watching the nature of the interaction, those kinds of things, much more carefully than are those of us who regard ourselves as humanists. And I think that's good. It's much more careful thinking. My problem with the social scientific enterprise is a much more deeply philosophical one. And it's a problem that I have with the Enlightenment, frankly, because all this box making, you know, Descartes would love this. You know, divide the whole world into little boxes. If you're in this box, I know who you are. The problem is almost nobody fits in a box. What do you do with this system of races? Where do you put Samoans, Filipinos? Yeah, I mean, they're kind of Asians, sorta. Or are they Pacific Islanders? Where do you put Mexicans? Kind of depends on how much they look like Native America, how much they look like Europe, how much they look like Africa, which part of it they want to talk about, you know? Where do you put my kids whose mom is Chinese American, whose dad is a pink boy? Okay? You know? What do you do with that? Okay? So my problem isn't with the careful thinking. My problem is with the notion that the boxes are what's really real. And also with the notion that there are these kind of universal laws. about how people are. I'm a religious guy. I come from a long line of Baptist preachers, which is why I get kind of hysterical in front of people. No, because we're going to have an altar call in a minute, folks. You've got to believe. Oh, sorry. Anyway, it comes from that place, okay? Anyway, and I can't believe I did that. And I don't believe like all the things I used to believe. And, my grandmother is in heaven at this moment, you know, praying for me. So you should step back because there might be a bolt of lightning. But, you know, we used to go to church. And I still do a lot of the time. And my then wife and I, we would listen to these church people and sometimes listen to psychologists tell us men are like this, women are like that, okay? You know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, that kind of stuff, you know? No, men and women are from Earth. Get over it. Because we would look at each other and she would say to me, okay, Paul, so then if that's the way men are and that's the way women are, she would say, then how come you're the girl, Paul? Because, you know, I got plumbing one way and character the other. Because all of this stuff is just much more elastic than we give it credit for when we embrace the Enlightenment with too much enthusiasm. Not arguing that social science isn't good stuff. Please, major in sociology. The smartest undergraduate I ever taught. It was really cool. She graduated this year. She's going to graduate school at Stanford. She's a little kid out of little Saigon, first kid in her family to be able to spell college. And she's going to graduate school in sociology, and that's good stuff. But you have to have a healthy sense of skepticism about the things that people are telling you are eternally and universally true. Every time somebody's trying to say you, this is the way it is, you know, put in that automatic 30% discount factor. Yes, and your name would be?
Karen.
Karen, and your question is? Is there one area in the world that seems to be less racist than the others? they are magnificently differently racist from each other. And several, you know, if you go to France, people there will tell you, absolutely, we don't believe in race, we only believe in citizenship. And if you are a citizen of the French Republic, you have all the same rights as anybody else, and we do not see race at all. They will tell you that in France. And so my friend Taufik Jabali, who I just spent some time with last week in Paris, a guy who speaks perfect, pure Parisian French, he's Tunisian Parisian, is... He's completely unaccented on the phone, and we're looking for an apartment for him. And so he calls up someplace and says, I'd like to rent your apartment. And they say, sure, come on over. And he comes over, and they say, oh, we just rented that. And so then he comes back to me, we got to look again, we need another place. And so I say, let me check it out, let me try it out. So I go over and say, hi, do you have an apartment for rent? And they say, sure. Okay, because no, they just don't want to deal with it. Yeah, there is that kind of stuff everywhere. Wherever there is dividing into different degrees of usness and domination of some by others. And that almost makes you want to believe in original sin. You know, I mean, it's people, you know, people treat each other rotten at every turn. God bless us. I'm happy to take a couple more questions if you want. Okay, are there more questions? Going once. Yes, there's a question back there. No, she's flinching for the door. Okay. Okay, somebody else? Well, I thank you. You've been very patient. You laughed at some of the jokes. Some of them you didn't even notice were jokes, but that's okay. Thank you very much. I'll see you.
You have been listening to a lecture given by Professor Paul Spickard on April 29th of 2005, at California State University, Channel Islands. Dr. Spickard teaches courses in race, ethnicity, religion, and history at the University of California at Santa Barbara. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.